rubbing shoulders with CEOs and millionaires. I've never seen my vision be more crystal clear. Look in the mirror, see the change in who I used to be. I kept going, new success will come eventually. But ask about me back then, they said I wouldn't make it. Nowadays they doubt less and tend to ask for favors. Poetic music, that's realness, don't let them tell you different. And if you ever lost in doubt, then follow your intuition. These words of wisdom is for those who's trying to find their purpose. Don't be living just to die, cause only death is certain. I'm working hard so I can toast to my accomplishments. Cause see I lost it all and I ain't been the same since. I'm more focused, more ambitious, more everything. Grew up with nothing, now I appreciate the finer things. I know it's real when at the shows they ask for autographs. And now they know the name, they ain't gotta ask.
All right, back again in the next part of the series, I have Steve Kanjes, who's also part of the Denver Jewish War Veterans Post 344, based out of Temple Sinai in Denver, Colorado. First of all, thanks for taking the time to do this, Steve. I know you got stuff going on and just been kind of a weird time for everybody, but I always appreciate the folks that can make the time for this.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So generally, we kind of just run down the list a little bit. So obviously, are you from Denver originally?
I'm a native of Denver.
Oh, uh-huh. Perfect. And then what part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in East Denver, the Mayfair community.
Okay.
Would it be, East Colorado Boulevard, Colorado Boulevard and Monaco, south of Colfax, north of 8th Avenue.
Yeah,
Dexter Street was the actual 13th and Dexter Street.
Got it. And so don't even have to ask you how you ended up in Colorado, or your hometown. Then what year were you born?
1945.
Okay. You were the start of the baby boom, huh?
Start of the baby boom. Actually, I wasn't even, I think it was, 46 was the actual baby boomer beginning,
for being accurate as possible, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. But it's still, I think, part of that.
Gotcha. And then just tell me a little bit about like growing up. Were your parents from Denver? Did they move from somewhere else or?
No. Well, my dad was born in Lithuania.
Okay.
Came to this country in I think about 1921. He was in his early 20s. I believe he was born in 1899. So he was in his early 20s when he came to this country. It is my thought that he was probably sponsored by an older brother who came here first. He was one of 10 siblings.
Wow.
I think my grandfather was a rabbi in Vilna. And then he started, just kind of like learned English, gradually. Mm-hmm. I think he started working as maybe he was a dishwasher at National Jewish Hospital.
Okay.
At the time, he ended up owning a dry cleaning business, a small one. And had a small shop over on 6th Avenue in Congress Park, I think like on 6th and Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the brother that actually I think sponsored him coming over. He was the tailor. Another brother was a presser. And he did the deliveries in his old Chevy panel truck that I can remember. And what they did is they actually sent the laundry to another place, you know, have it dry cleaned. But a lot of his, his clients were around that area, Circle Drive. He had some very nice clients. And some affluent clients as well in that part of town.
It's always interesting to hear the family history, because a lot of times when people came over, they were educated, but they were educated in their own native language, and seamstress and those kind of things were something that was a hot commodity at the time. When you look at the Lower East Side, like in the 1890s, 1900s, 80% of all the garments were made in the Lower East Side at that time. When you look at that with the influx, you know, you see that talent in that way, in the tenements and everything else. And just to see that migration of that talent move west, I think it just is very interesting. I just wanted to kind of put that out there.
Oh, no, I think you're right. I mean, like, in fact, a lot of, some of the Jewish dry goods merchants started out, you know, on the wagons, you know, just pulling wagons, you know, with their various rags, whatever they were trying to sell at the time.
Right.
This is how they got started. Some of them, you know, many of them, or some of them, you know, became very, very successful later on.
Right.
You know, opening up stores and that kind of thing. So, and then he got also into, investment properties at the time, and purchased some stuff. And I don't remember much about that. It was, and my mom used to do the bookkeeping, you know, for the cleaning business.
Okay.
That I remember. And we had a pretty normal household.
Yeah. How many siblings did you have?
Yeah, I have a brother, an older brother, and he was an attorney. He's pretty much retired at this point in time, and he and I have done some investment, real estate investment stuff together. He has some things of his own. I've had a few things of my own. I got into the business years ago with a friend of mine from college. After I got out of the military, and I was just doing some odd jobs after the military. I was working for at the time Gart Brothers, and then I was started doing some work for. Sprinkler companies, and I was doing some field labor, and then one company I ended up working in their office, doing some of their book work, and also doing some of the residential sprinkler the design works for the residential sprinklers.
Got it.
Kind of thing. And then this, my friend, he worked in the stock market in New York guy.
Those New Yorkers.
Very aggressive guy. And we started doing very slowly, just buying some properties, small properties, duplexes. Part of it was mostly in Congress Park. And then we would do some work, cosmetic work on it, and then rent them out. And then at some point in time, I was still doing, you know, regular, just working hours. And then when I get off of work, then I'd go and I'd help him at night do some work and start the day over, you know, my regular job. And then at some point in time, I think I just, we got out, I quit the job and just went full time working on these properties with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of these things that, we just almost worked like 7 days a week, because I had this thing, this mentality that I didn't want to fail at this.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I had to make it succeed. In order to make it succeed, I had to work my ass off.
Fear's a great motivator.
Do whatever was necessary. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like, I don't know how it is with your brother, but I know I grew up quite competitive, and I'm the oldest brother. And so, you know, mm-hmm. we constantly try to one-up each other as far as anything goes regarding sports or career or what have you, you know? So was that something right. that was in your DNA as well, as like a little friendly?
No, not really. I wasn't competing with Michael. I mean, it was just, first of all, there was a difference of 5 to 6 years between us.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of, like, you know, he had his own group of friends that he was hanging out with and doing things with. And I had my own. And I mean, a lot of the people that he hung out with were lawyers, fellow lawyers, you know, people that he had gone to law school with as well.
Right.
And so he just had his own niche. He was a very, very good lawyer. He was a kind of a family lawyer, divorce lawyer, did a lot of divorces.
Got it.
And very successful at it. And so he just had his own niche. And I was just doing my own thing. So there was really no competition. I mean, he did what he did and I did what I did. And
that's probably the more healthy way to act.
Yeah, yeah. We both, you know, obviously tried to succeed on our own.
Yeah.
On our own merits and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, we're kind of the same. I mean, what unit or what branch of service did you serve in?
I was in the Army.
Okay. And then from what year to what year?
This is where my notes come in. So I went to basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, right around the 1st of November, 1967. My notes say it looks through January 1968.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, it's could have been longer, but I do remember that it was very cold there, wintertime. I think there's a lot of humidity in that area. So it's very, I mean, the humidity, having the humidity, you know, also adds to the coldness, I guess.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. And I know that we were living in contemporary type of barracks.
Yeah.
Bricks, but it was very cold there. And I remember a time that I was just having a terrible, terrible cough. And I was buying bottles of cough medicine from the commissary, and I'm just drinking it. And finally, I was lucky enough to have a leave during Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And went home, and basically I stayed in bed the entire time when I was at home, you know, eating mother's chicken soup and God knows whatever else she could give me. And I was ready. And at any rate, I had pretty much recuperated by the time I went back. And one of the reasons I had to do this is because I didn't want to recycle back through basic training.
No, I totally get that. You
know, I mean, I hated it to begin with. And
so did you get drafted or did you volunteer?
You know, so I got drafted mm-hmm. in the beginning. And then I enlisted. And I found this, there was this MOS or this branch of the Army, Army Security Agency, which was, I don't know what you call it. It was, you know, somewhat of doing intelligence stuff.
Okay.
And so the recruiter told me I would, instead of wearing an olive drab uniform, you know, they fixed me up in a tuxedo, you know, PPK, two beautiful women, both arms. And that's what I would be doing, you know.
Oh, yeah. Laid on real thick, huh?
You know, that sounds, and I said, you know, that sounds pretty good, you know, tuxedo, you know, beautiful women. And, and it was a 4-year enlistment. So after basic training, I ended up going to Fort Devens for school. And it shows here that they had an MOS, which was an 09B00. And I'm not quite sure what that was. But there was also I started out as an 05H, which was a Morse code intercept.
Okay.
And I was doing okay with that. It was kind of like difficult, and I'm not quite sure why. I don't know if I could just trying to, you know, get it, or maybe my hearing wasn't as good as it should have been.
Oh, it sucks. I can tell you that from personal experience.
Well, I mean, you know, after, you know, I mean, you know, probably where you were, you know, a lot of combat, loud noises, explosions, and things of that nature. It's certainly affect you. But then there was the issue of, I heard through like the grapevine that they were graduates of the Morse intercept. They were looking for candidates to join, to go to Vietnam, and join up, I guess, with infantry units. Mm-hmm. And I was a little surprised by that, because what they told me is that, well, you know, you're, you know, as an Army security, you go through this very strict security clearance. And as far as I know, I mean, they talked to a lot of people about me, you know, my character, then this and this and that. So I thought, it, you know, security clearance was a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of intimating that, you know, somebody with my security clearance would not necessarily go into a combat environment situation.
Right.
And so I, for good or for bad, I think my hearing got a little worse, put it that way.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is probably, you know, something that should not go on the video, but they got wind of it, and I ended up being on some like extra duty stuff, you know, like CQ, right. KP, and this and that. That was all right. And And then I ended up going into another school a while back when it opened up. It was a 05K MOS, and that was electronics. I think it was an electronics intercept. And that entailed, you know, working with radio receivers and intercepting, learning how to, you know, to use the equipment to intercept. It was basically encrypted code.
Got it.
Stuff that we got, and then we sent it to another department to analyze. And then when they got through with that, they ended up sending it to the National Security Agency, NSA, in Fort Meade.
Yeah.
That's where the final product went to. So I finished that school at Fort Devens. And then I got my orders to go to Sobe, Okinawa. And this was, this is probably right around the beginning of July of 1968.
Okay.
And I was assigned to, looks like Company H, USA SATR, as an 05K20. So I'm just trying to figure out United States ASAT. I'm not quite sure what that stands for. And let's see. And then it looks like back in November, and then in November of 68, I was transferred to a different company, Company A. And so I did that, and Okinawa was interesting. They had a large Air Force base, Kadena, where they were flying B-52s out for bombing sorties, Vietnam. There, they had two. One of them was in Kadena. And the other one, I believe, was they're flying 52s out of Guam as well for that.
And so tell me a little bit about Okinawa. I mean, I know my unit's there. They have a forward battalion there, but obviously it's always interesting to get other perspectives on that. Where I know it's a kind of a mixed bag because, you know, being a service member there has a negative connotation. As far right. as the locals, they're not particularly happy about that. And then they're also not happy that Japan brokered a deal to put most of the American military on their island. So tell me a little bit about just the environment that you were in during that time. And
the environment there was different than it is now, I think.
Okay.
I mean, because that was way back then. I mean, I know what it's, I think it's different now, like what you say. But we, they, you know, I think they like the extra income coming from the GIs.
I'm sure.
And there was a, there was a small little village or town outside of the, I don't know if it was like outside of, I think it was outside of the air base. And so while I was there, it was weird. It was just weird. I was just, we got a, I don't know. Now I can't remember. Maybe it was in Thailand that I got, that we got a small place to share a few of us going into town. But I was going into, I go into town periodically, and do it all GIs do. Drink at the bars and,
So were you intrigued by the military before you got the call up, or was that just something that just kind of happened and you just kind of ran with it?
Well, in a way I was. And I'll tell you, just to preface what's going on, when I was at CU, I got into a, it was kind of like, it wasn't a, I don't know what you call it. It's kind of like an ROTC science class or something. I don't know. It was a more of a civilian. It was a more of a civilian class, as opposed to wearing military uniform and things of that nature.
Right.
And what I wanted to do is I really wanted to get a, and this was an Air Force ROTC, and I wanted to get see if I could, I was interested in getting a commission going to officer's candidate school.
Okay.
After that. Yeah. When I finished up with college.
Was there somebody that influenced you during that time period? Like maybe an instructor or a professor?
I can't remember. It was just, I think it was part of my, my studies, and I don't know why, it just seemed something that I had an interest in doing, serving my country at the time. But I thought it would be interesting, to go in as an officer.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, as it turned out, I was kind of a small guy, and I had a slight weight problem at the time.
Okay.
I think I was just, a few pounds, couple pounds under the weight qualification. So I remember in the summertime, I was just gorging on, I was trying to get everything to, to fatten me up, just to put weight on me. And it just, I was trying to get a waiver. They wouldn't give me the waiver.
Yeah.
So I was disappointed. I really was. And this takes me back to actually just to something else, is that maybe this is the afterthought that I had after getting out of the Army, going back to CONUS from Thailand, was maybe I, by that time, I could have re-enlisted and maybe gone to and signed up for officer candidate school at that point in time.
Right.
After my 4 years four years as an enlisted person, and see what would have happened.
How did your parents take you getting drafted?
Well, I think they were both worried.
Yeah.
But they didn't show it. I mean, mothers.
Yeah, for sure.
The fathers, I think they like to put on a more air of good for you. And, I'm sure you'll make out okay, this and that. But
yeah,
I think in the back of their mind that, I think he was, a little bit worried too. He dropped me off at the wherever it was I had to go. When they sent me to Leonard Wood, or flew me to Missouri to Leonard Wood, and he got pretty emotional. We both got pretty emotional. Leaving, and he was kind of an emotional guy anyway. But up until that point, I think when he saw me walking away, suitcase, duffel, but whatever I was carrying, you know.
Yeah.
He knew he wasn't going to see me for a while. And I don't know if there was a, you know, good riddance or, you know, Godspeed, one or the other.
Right.
But
did anybody serve in your family before you?
My brother served in a kind of like a National Guard unit. He was with, did a small commitment with MP school at Fort Gordon.
Okay.
Yeah. And, but I think, you know, he didn't serve very long. I can't remember. I don't know. Maybe it was just like a reserve unit or something like that.
Right. It's just an interesting time when you came in, and how many years did you do in total active duty?
Well, I went in, so like November to November of 68. And then I left for, beginning of July, 1971, returned stateside.
Mm-hmm.
And then for 2 years, I was on standby reserve.
Got it.
Until officially, discharged.
Yeah, it's got to be an interesting time just in history, because you obviously have seen, obviously Vietnam started in the early 60s. I think a lot of people forget that.
Correct.
And kind of slowly just added more to it. We had the Kennedys' assassinations at the same time within a couple span of a couple years.
Yeah, exactly.
MLK. You had a lot of like what I would think is like pressure points and tension within society. And I always find it interesting, like, that people still at this time still believed in the country. Like you said, you were proud to serve and going forward with that, because you felt like it was your duty and your obligation as a citizen. So I always find that awesome.
Yeah. I didn't have a problem with that. The media is just, you're getting a lot of media, on the war at that point in time. And it's just, it's violent. It's horrific. What you want to do is, I wanted to not be in harm's way. There were people that were just so less fortunate.
Right.
They were just drafted directly into the infantry, and it was just up to fate as to what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And, when I was in Thailand, I remember a couple of times, that there was some, field station there was kind of like, I don't know if it was being overrun, but they had to shut down, and then we would have to take over, kind of like do double duty, kind of like take over some of their stuff. So
got it.
So I kind of like had an idea what was going on. This didn't happen a lot. It just, I think when I was there, I think it only happened maybe like a couple of times.
So during that span of 3 years, you were in Oki. You went to Thailand. Were you actually in Vietnam proper as well?
Not really. No.
Okay.
No. I mean, I thought that, they have a field station, in Fubai. And there was, I don't know, they were talking about maybe sending some of us over on a TDY status, but that never occurred. I mean, it would only been for a very, very short term.
And during that time, you mentioned that, you were talking to one of your friends. Do you still keep in touch with people from your unit, from your active duty?
Just him. It's kind of like been a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
For a long, long time, is that we would, I mean, until the Zoom thing came, we would just talk to each other on the phone.
Yeah.
And then he re-enlisted, and he ended up going to Germany. Well, he was in something they call a research and development, a little bit, something different than what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was doing some of that while he was still in Thailand. And then when he was in Germany, he was stationed in Berlin, and he was just doing that. And then when he got out, he lucked into like a really good a company doing a lot of defense work.
Yeah.
It's GTE or something like that. They were based out in California. Okay. And he was a project manager for a lot of different things. I mean, he just really developed into a very, very capable individual. And so far as knowing this stuff and managing it and that kind of thing. So so his work in the service kind of like propelled him, his career in civilian life.
I was going to ask you, what do you think, what kind of skills do you think you learned during that time, technically, but then also what'd you learn about yourself that you kind of brought back with you, you think, when you came back home?
Well, I think, so I was like lucky enough to be like both in Okinawa and Thailand, they call a trick chief, it's like a supervisor for we were on shifts.
Yeah.
It was a 24-hour operation. So
got it.
Start days and evenings and then graveyards. And between those, we would have a couple of days off and then start the new shift. So wherever I was like a trick chief and, just made sure that, things were running smoothly. And what we were responsible for is basically just making sure that the radio equipment was always calibrated properly to get the maximum signal strength, regarding our intercept capabilities. They were using these kind of like circular antenna things, and we were intercepting transmissions.
Yeah,
a lot of from the mainland, from China and both Koreas and Vietnam and a lot of places in the Pacific Rim.
Got it.
Area. So just basically just making sure that things are running, running smoothly and correctly and, that kind of thing. I always felt pretty responsible as an individual.
Was that before the military too, or just like as you kind of matured going?
No, I think during the military, I don't think I was that responsible before that time.
Right.
And so
you came back in 71 and then you were on inactive reserves basically for that time frame.
For 2 years, for about 2 years.
When you came back, how did you feel about coming back, how the kind of the country was and how you were treated when you came back?
I didn't feel mistreated. I mean, I heard that a lot of Vietnam vets were mistreated and And I just, you know, I don't know exactly what to, what that was about, or I think, I don't know if media had anything to do with that. I mean, there was a lot of anti-war rhetoric, and when you look back at the history of Vietnam, I'm not sure we belong there to begin with.
Yeah.
I think there's, you know, people say that we should have been there. Other people say that it was really not our business to be there. I mean, I think what they wanted to do, they just wanted to nationalize the country under communism. You know, and of course, at that time, you know, everybody's pretty anti-communist.
But, yeah, no, it makes sense.
You don't really know anything as an individual.
Right.
And you're not making any of the decisions. So you rely on the people who are at the top making the decisions, the Johnsons and the Westmorelands and, you know, yeah, whoever was in charge there. And you think that they know better than you do. And as it turns out, later on, history tells us, well, they really didn't.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question pertaining to during that time, Muhammad Ali's stance in the Vietnam War? Like, what did you think of that? Did you think at the time that that was a courageous move on his part? Did you respect it? Did you agree with it? Did you disagree with it?
You know, at the time, I think I was kind of like neutral about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think one way or the other. I mean, I think that he had his, for whatever reason, he had his reason that just something that he didn't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people believed in it, other people, you know, didn't. I mean, I knew guys from college, just, you know, a couple, two or three guys who, you know, they were afraid they were going to be drafted, you know, and, you know, went up to Canada.
Oh, wow.
I said, okay, you know, if that's their decision.
Yeah.
I mean, they may, I was thinking, well, you know, they may regret it later, or they may not. Or they may not regret it. One sec, that's just one second. Listen, I'm on a Zoom. I have to call you back.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's my brother.
Yeah, no worries.
He always calls. Make sure I'm healthy. Make sure I'm alive.
Yeah, well, that's a good brother.
Always looks after my back. Yeah, no, I don't think I wasn't disgusted by him. And at the same time, I just thought he was making his stand. There were a lot of people making their stand about it. This was a very controversial war.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
I mean, there were some people who, you know, who just, you know, a lot of anti-war rhetoric going on. There was a lot in people who did believe in the cause and, you know, thought it was the right thing to do. And at the time, I thought it was the right thing to do, but
sure.
But then you learn, you know, history at some point in time gives you a different perspective.
Yeah.
Of things. And, you know, you just, you know, you're doing some reading and, you know, I mean, there were some lies that were told.
Sure.
You know, by the administration, you know, in order to, you know, they were, Merrick was trying to look good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always, I always find the people that at least are open to new information, I think, right, are the easiest to get along with, because at least you're listening. You know what I mean? As more information comes, that should change your perspective one way or the other. It shouldn't just leave you on the sidelines having a staunch opinion about something 30 years later. You know, like, things come out that could change your perspective on individuals or organizations or anything else. So,
yeah, exactly. Sure.
So the 70s, you got back. So you ended up getting into working again, for the family, or what did you get into after you came?
No, I didn't. My dad still had his, at that time, I think my dad's, I can't remember if my dad had retired from the cleaning business, you know, they'd sold it, or I think it was awfully close to that. I think my dad was, he might have sold it at that point in time, or was no longer involved with that.
Right.
Because he was getting out of an age. But he was involved in some investment properties. And so after working, a couple of years or so at odd jobs, doing what I was doing, and then joining my friend and trying to get, this thing, our rental property business together and moving it forward.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point in time, I think I kind of like started helping my dad out a little bit.
Right.
I didn't want to get too involved. but there are some things that, he would call on me to have me look at, and, so I would go home and take a look.
And what'd you study in school?
Well, my major was like political science. I don't think I got I enjoyed the subject. I enjoyed it, because there's a lot of different things about it. There's political philosophy and other things. But yeah, that was the other thing. I think at one time I had a fantasy of going into the Foreign Service, except you have to be fairly good at probably a foreign language. Which, sorry about that, but I
not the specialty.
Not my specialty. No.
Yeah.
It's a very, very difficult test as well.
So, I wanted to ask you as well. Like, obviously, you've been doing what you've been doing for the last 30 plus years with, properties and different stuff like that. Can you recall a time in what, obviously you're a little bit older than myself, so just where the polarization of the country is the way it is today? Have you felt the tension like we have today before?
No.
And what would you, if people sat you down in a panel and they're asking you, like, what could be done to bridge the gap of the divide, what would you recommend?
That's very difficult. I have my own reasons. A lot of times they may not be shared by other people. First of all, my political bent is, I've been a conservative for quite a while. I was a Democrat for a long, long time.
Sure.
Okay. And then for some reason, there was a time that the Democrats just kind of, they just kind of lost me.
Do you remember that moment specifically?
You know what? I don't. I think it's just been over a gradual period of time. But today there would just be no question, because And I don't want to offend you. I don't want to offend anybody else. But I just think that I know how Democrats feel about the, you know, about the Republicans, and mm-hmm. conservatives are, you know, not only are they all a bunch of racists and right wing supremacists and white nationalists and this and that, and sure we are.
No,
anti-Semitic, but in my opinion, the Democrats had really been at this point in time had really been taken over by the left wing,
right? I think it's from both.
I think they've moved over very, very much so. In other words, the Democrat Party is not the Democrat Party of my dad's party.
Got it.
Or even my party years and years ago.
No, I can totally understand that, and I definitely respect your opinion on that. And yeah. I think though people like you, they sit at the crossroads because obviously they know the other side of America where you could still have civil discourse with each other and break bread,
right.
But yeah. You didn't have to. It wasn't like you're rooting for the Broncos against the Chiefs kind of situation, right? Like,
exactly. In other words, it's very hard to say. It's, at some point in time, you know, it was just, there was civil discourse among people. And even, you know, on the, I remember, you know, the idea of, Tip O'Neill sipping whiskey with Ronald Reagan, you know, back in the day.
Yeah.
And, they're probably, you know, at each other's throat, you know, politically. But, you know, they were very close friends.
So when
and they could talk to each other. It's I think things just got so polarized after Trump's win. Mm-hmm. I think the Trump win just caught everybody by surprise.
For sure.
And I think I have a theory that obviously a lot of people voted for Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people also thought that Clinton was kind of like a despicable individual.
No,
and definitely. I thought she was. And I think Trump was maybe like a question mark. Trump didn't come across very well either, period, even when he was campaigning. He was not my favorite. He was not my first choice, second choice, or probably even my third choice.
So since we're on the topic, out of the Republican Party, obviously we don't have a McCain-like character anymore, but do you, I just think that particular individual garnered the respect of everybody because of obviously what he's been through for the country, but then also being able to be sticking to his values, but then also being pragmatic when you have to be in regards to certain votes, you know, and he's not just always voting a party line. And even though people may disagree with him, they respect him regardless. You know, I was watching some video when some of this stuff was already kind of brewing back when he was running for president, as far as people trying to discredit Obama in a sense of, you know, the birther issue and certain things. And he put a big kibosh on that. And I respect him very much so for saying, you know what, this guy's a colleague and he's an American. Like, as much he's like, this is telling people at the town halls, like, that's simply not true. It's not true. And they were booing him and everything else. And I think it takes an incredible amount of courage to stand up to your constituency to be able to say, hey, this is wrong and here's why. And we're, for some reason, I feel we don't have that right now. Would you agree with that in that sense?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, you can disagree with somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his policies were, I had some issues with McCain, but the big thing that I had with Trump was, you know, when he called out McCain. I mean, I still can't forgive Trump for that. I think that was just a despicable remark. And no matter how much I support him and like him, that was just totally uncalled for.
Yeah.
And Trump does that. I mean, the problem, what I tell people about Trump is that he lacks a filter between his brain and his mouth. I think he's a terrible communicator unless he has a teleprompt
right
by him. Obama wasn't a great communicator either unless he had a teleprompt. Obama did. I mean, you know, Obama was great. You know, he had great inflection and he's a great communicator when he had, you know, words in front of him, when he spoke extemporaneously.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever heard him speak extemporaneously, but I thought he was a big flop.
Yeah.
You know, he was always just searching, you know, searching for words, searching for things to say, you know, to the camera, to whoever was interviewing him at the time. But yeah, it's just horrible. Just what's happening is horrible. And I don't know what it's going to take to get back to some sensibility and some sort of normalcy. I'm almost glad that Trump's leaving. I would have liked to see him get a second term. Didn't happen.
Right.
Let's move on. We have a new administration. Let's see what they're going to do. Let's see if people, Democrats, congressional Democrats, caucus are going to start pulling the strings on Biden, or Biden's going to have hopefully some spine and just make decisions on his own and not be too influenced by, you know, and what I think is going to be maybe a lot of pressure from the leftists, you know, from the Democratic left. And let's hope that, you know, we have some sane Republicans.
Yeah.
Conservatives, whomever, you know, will work with him as well. And, you know, we can make decisions together and, you know, pull this country out of this abyss that we seem to be in right now. It's I've never seen it so bad in my entire life. Everything that's happening is just absolutely crazy. You know, here you have a president who's just been impeached twice.
Yeah.
Never seen that happen before.
Right. Yeah.
And this is only like a few days before the inauguration, you know?
Yeah. I just, and people are, I think they're fed up with the ineptitude within Congress of not being able to get legislation passed that the people generally want, regardless of what side of the aisle it's on.
Yeah,
it's,
no, and I agree. I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Let's get back to business. Let's get back to congressional business. The problem is, you know, they're just spending too much time on a lot of BS.
Yeah.
I don't know if FCC would cut me off on if I said the actual word. But, in other words, there was too much time. Look, when it came to the collusion issue with Trump,
mm-hmm.
I don't know spent way too much time with that. And I blame the Democrats for that. I mean, they just wanted to get Trump, period. Instead of doing their business, Trump's not a, he's got a lot of faults. I agree with that. He says a lot of things that are really stupid and he shouldn't say it, should have never said it. I mean, I could be critical of Trump, you know, the next guy.
Yeah.
It's the next guy.
So, I mean, being that you have conservative leanings, what do you wish for the party to do in the future?
The Republican Party?
Yeah.
Disband and start over again. That's what I would suggest.
Yeah. Yeah. Just get it over.
Part of it is that there's no unity in the Republican Party.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's just a lot of disunity. In other words, there was a lot of non-Trumpers, Republicans, you know, who fought against Trump tooth and nail. There were a lot of conservative Trump who did support him. There has to be some unification in the Republican Party. Democrats were so much more unified to begin with. First of all, they're all unified against Trump.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Second of all, I mean, they had a really good working organization. And they just, but now it's, Republicans don't do that. I don't know. Now that the Republicans have the White House and the House and basically the Senate, they pretty much have their way to do anything that they want. I don't know what's going to happen.
This may sound like a cynical question, but do you really believe that the federal government has that much influence over your day-to-day life?
No.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, in a sense of like,
I don't think so. I do what I want to do. But then I stay within the boundaries of the law.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of misinformation on both sides, Republicans or conservatives or, right wingers are saying that the government is squashing, our liberties and constitutional rights. And then the Democrats are complaining that, I don't know what the hell they're complaining about. Not sure what they're complaining about. They always seem to be complaining about something or another. Normally, Trump and his behaviors and what he's doing to the country. And Trump has done a lot of good things for this country. And I don't know why people can't see that, but I think they just hate him so much that, they just overlook all the policies, the positive policies that's been done in the short time that he's been in office. And this is also up against a lot of adversarial, adversarial wall from the Democrats. I'm not talking about the general population Democrats. I'm talking about the congressional Democrat caucus. I'm talking about the Pelosi's and the Schumer's and the AOC's and the Presley's and the, Tlaib's and
right.
Omar, whatever her name is.
So were you always politically active, or was that just something that you just had like an interest in?
No, not actually. Probably it was in the last maybe 15, 20 years or so.
Yeah.
You know, like I say, for a good part of my life, I was a Democrat. And both parties, one party won, good transfer of power, and the other party, and this thing is just absolutely crazy. I don't understand Trump, period, anymore. I think he's just gotten so delusional. I don't know where he's coming from. I've lost a lot of respect. Obviously, I've lost a lot of respect for him at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's gonna go out of office as a disgrace. Which is unfortunate. Could have been different. He could have acted different. He could have behaved differently. But that's not his, that's not his MO.
Yeah.
He's not a politician. He's a businessman. He's just his own person, and you can't rein him in. I don't think anybody could rein him in.
Yeah. People like that haven't been told no basically ever. And so you get to a point where people are actually, you're going to surround yourself in the business world generally with people that agree with you to keep your.
So you don't want to do that. And that's one of the bad things about politicians and business people is that you don't want yes people around you. You do want people to question your policy.
Mm-hmm.
And to discuss them civilly and to say, I'm looking at this thing in a different manner. Let me explain why. If you don't like my reasoning then that's fine. But and I think that would happen that if they think there's a back in the, I don't know when it was. I think back in the Bush era that there were a lot of generals going to Bush, to W,
yeah,
and to Rumsfeld, and they were showing their concerns about certain things that was going on, in the Middle East, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and I think a couple of these guys lost their jobs.
Yeah,
got their pink slips.
So in the later stages of your career and life, do you still have some plans? Do you have any goals still that you want to accomplish?
I would like to retire one of the days. I think the only way I can retire is to probably sell off, some of my properties.
That's not a horrible thing, right?
No. It's not. I just maybe just have to wait, for the right time. I don't know if I can do it right now, but I'll have to. I enjoy working on the properties. I enjoy what I do.
Yeah.
That's nice. Ben, it's really strange. I work a lot, but, at the end of the day, I'm okay. Mentally, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot. I don't know why. It's an interesting, I question myself all the time, but I don't have anxieties about certain things. I don't feel pushed. I don't say, I've got all this to do. I've got all this to finish. I've got that and I've got this. What am I going to do? Pull your hair out. I want to stay healthy.
Yeah. And I for me, I'm the same way, to be honest. I think that people are like, you work a lot, and I do, But it also gives me purpose and direction. Like every day I know why I wake up every morning, you know, and that makes me happy, which makes me produce, to do whatever I need to do, like getting this going with you guys, doing other things, even though I'm halfway across the planet, you know, like that's important to me because I'm honoring my word. And then also I really enjoy talking to you guys because you guys give me a lot of perspective that you guys are a little bit older than my parents are still super young. My dad just retired at 62 and my mom is not even 60 yet. And I'm
40. Really?
Yeah. And I'm in my 40s. So they had me super, super young. And so I get to talk with you guys because then I get a little more nuanced perspective of somebody maybe a decade or so or more older than my dad, right? And so they look at things in a different lens than even my parents. And so I get a lot of that from you guys, and I always want to thank you guys for that because you guys lived through some different scenarios that we just don't understand, you know, in a sense. I was born in the 80s. So my entire being was, you know, like born in Germany, American dad, service member to a German mother, all that good stuff. And my whole history revolves around Reagan, the Berlin Wall, and like all the after effects of that, you know? And so, yeah, it's go ahead.
Well, I was just saying that it's unfortunate that we can't, that we, you don't have the same opportunities interviewing World War II, you know, because again, it was an entirely different period of time as well. You know, you're coming out of the Depression, the war starting up in Europe, the Third Reich, growing, under Hitler, and then the war in the Pacific, and, entirely different. And these are the guys that were really heroes. I mean, they went all out, you know.
Well, between that and then, I would honestly say I'm more impressed with them when they got back. Like the, you know, roll your sleeves up. Let's get back to work. And most of the veterans were entrepreneurs. So they started their own companies and their own little mom and pop shops and whatever, and just grinded. And I think the biggest takeaway from them, from the guys that I met at the post, I was fortunate enough to meet, there was three guys, and they were just so animated and active to the end, you know, like they were just active participants in our group. And I always found that. So Sid Schaffner, we had, so we had Arthur, Art Diamond, and then we had the other guy as well, who was like doing like rocket propulsion systems and stuff like that for Raytheon, I think, locally for like 30 years or so. And Bernie's the same way. Bernie's 90 and he's still doing stuff, you know, like I look up to you guys immensely in that sense. And like, you don't have to chill out if you don't want to, basically. That's the way I look at it. And I'm always happy to see other people that think the same way. Like if you're happy and you want to be involved, then go out and do your thing, you know? And I think that's
I'm really, first of all, I'm very glad that I got involved with this organization. meeting the various people, and I was happy to. I'm very glad that I met, you know, some of the, you know, the very few World War II vets that were still around, before they died, became, you know, kind of like good friends, acquaintance with, like Leon.
Tupper. I can't believe he was driving at 95 years old.
I didn't know how old he was, but he just didn't look his age.
No, not at all.
And he was just very, you know, and he was just always very, you know, we always had some great conversations,
mm-hmm.
You know, before the meeting and just always enjoyed him. And I was just, you know, very upset. And then, you know, the other who just died, Jeffrey Mechanic, and you know he was very, very generous at the breakfast,
mm-hmm.
when I took his money. Give me, and you know he always, like, he's, you know, he gave me a $20 bill, and you know I said here's your change. He said keep it, you know. Said like all the time, you know, just like, or you know, you throw a few bucks, you know, mm-hmm. you know, $4, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, but every time he always, you know, gave a little extra money.
So I talked,
you know, into the, you know.
I talked with Ben Stein like maybe a week ago, and we were talking, and we said the kind of the same thing, where it's nice to go into a room where you don't have to explain yourself and who you are, and you can just sit down and schmooze, and nobody's really judging you or anything else.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Because
there's something to be said about that. And I think that we should do that a little bit more.
Yeah.
Just as a society,
political difference. I mean, everybody know that we get, you know, there's political differences. And I remember the animosity between, Dr. Gold and Bernie.
Yeah.
You know,
I talked with Bob too. He's doing okay. He asked me if I wanted to go flying with him. He had a crazy. Have you talked to him as well?
I have not talked to him for a long time. The funny story though, my wife years ago gave me it was a birthday gift to this flying club that he owned.
Okay.
I didn't know him. I didn't know who he was. and they were flying the A, what was it, A34, A, you know, the trainers, the
right
tandem, you know, the trainers.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't go up with me. It was another instructor who went up with me. And talk about being up and, you know, all right, take the stick.
Yeah.
You know. Jeez, but then what am I supposed to, you know, you start turning and all of a sudden you're looking down and oh my God, it's just, you know, your stomach is just, but I got the hang of it pretty quickly, and I was having a lot of fun, and that's there was awesome. Two of us, you know, we were trying to shoot each other down, whatever, but it was a lot of fun. And then, so I later learned that when I got in, he and Jim, we're at my synagogue at Rodev.
Okay.
And they were speaking there, and they, you know, they told, well, you know, we're with the Jewish War Post 344, and these are Jewish war veterans, and I'd never even heard of it before.
Right.
So I went up and I introduced myself, and you know, I said, yeah, you know, I might be interested in joining your organization.
Yeah.
You know, at that time.
So, you know, being that you've had a decent experience with that, I wanted to ask you, do you feel that, like, for example, I'm in decent communication with the CEO of Jewish Colorado. I'm part of the JCRC and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like me to reach out and try to get maybe at least so we have a roster of more Jewish veterans in the community? They may not be able to obviously go to the post or anything, but the fact that we know that they exist, you know, like the same with you, like you didn't know the organization existed, obviously
right.
had a positive experience. I think we could replicate that if we collectively work together, maybe this year. If I put up a little task force or something like that to kind of reach out to folks, do you think you'd be able to help with that a little bit? Or
I probably could. I mean, I don't know in what specifically way. I mean, I don't know, just making calls, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. Little things here and there.
I can make calls and just introduce myself and say, you know, I'm, you know, represent the Jewish war veterans, Denver Post, and we're an organization made up of various members of, you know, veterans of various campaigns and that kind of thing.
Because
mostly now it's
I think one, we have the time with the current situation, but then secondly, I don't want to regret missing out on maybe another story that we could have gotten, like Art Diamond's or, you know, Leon's and stuff like that, you know? I think that's the biggest thing for me.
Right. Well, I know that we've got some history on Sid.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was very interesting. And I don't know how much history we have on Art, but I'm sure from Ruth and from Linda. And
yeah.
There's going to be quite a bit. And Bernie.
Yeah, so I'm
Bernie, obviously. And you know, speaking of, have you been doing many interviews so far? Or?
Yeah, you're the seventh.
Okay.
So we're moving along. I mean,
I don't know if that's good or bad, or do you have some other pending? I just thought, you know, I think I was kind of like neutral in the beginning. And then I said, you know, this is probably something that, yeah, probably I need to do, you know, let's get this on tape or and do it. I didn't know how it was going to, you know, how it was going to go work out or. But yeah, it's been very good.
Yeah, it's like two buddies talking, you know, trying to get to know each other a little bit more. And
yeah, exactly.
The only thing is we don't have beers and we're not in the same spot.
Oh, there you go. I got to tell you, man, I am looking forward to get back into physical meetings.
Yeah. It's so unique in the situation. Like, I remember I hugged my aunt when I went to Germany for a little bit, and just the sheer kind of euphoria that you get from like touching somebody again or shaking somebody's hand, for example, it just seems so foreign now. And it's going to be weird again, getting back into that groove and not wearing a mask everywhere and all that stuff.
You know, I'm so used to like extending my hand out to somebody,
right,
and shaking their hand. It's just like, I mean, for a while, I mean, I was still doing it,
right,
just out of habit, and then I kind of like had to pull back, you know.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, I mean, you know, and just and I also like hugging people, you know, women, men,
The lack of physical touch, I think, is definitely, I'm sure they're going to do studies on this time period in a sense of like the mental health depreciation based on human contact.
Oh, yeah. Now, the people I feel the worst about are the kids.
Yeah.
Being able to go to school for so long. To having that social contact with their friends, and the idea of learning, virtual learning on a monitor is over my head. I just can't, you know. I couldn't do it.
No, I hear you.
I would have a hard time focusing on learning anything. In other words, I get more if I'm in a physical classroom with an instructor. I can focus more. I think it's just so much more helpful.
Yeah.
And ask questions. In other words, you get more attention. You can probably get more attention, even though, you know, maybe the classroom size is.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I did all my college online, my bachelor's and my MBA. And I got to say, you know, like I didn't think I would want to be in a classroom in that capacity. But we had I went to DU for my MBA, and we had an immersion where we got to go and meet other classmates that we had online. And it was a great experience. And so
yeah.
You got a taste of what maybe collegiate life would be like, because you're all in the same space. You all have the same schedules. You're not working on top of going to school in that sense. Right. And so like, I understand it now, and just fortunate enough to like not have been in a regular program and then have that deprived of me. You know, I don't know any different, but I can see how people are upset by, you know, paying that kind of money and then not getting the experience.
That's interesting. You know, you did all that online. I never had that experience. Of course, I never had any really computer technology. College, obviously, you know, we never worked. We didn't have laptops or, you know, it was just all.
You were hand jamming everything.
It was all note taking and that type of thing. So it was, you had to write quickly and you had to write, hopefully, fairly legibly.
When you wrote papers, did you have to type them on a typewriter, or did you have to handwrite them?
Well, if I was doing reports, I had a portable typewriter.
Okay.
You know, and
those things were heavy.
I wasn't the world's greatest typist either, you know.
Were you a pecker? Just like little fingers.
Yeah. Word and computer, it's, you know, you make a mistake, you know, you back up and you delete it, you know.
But just think about it now, like how kids have, they have no idea what whiteout is.
Yeah, no, I know. I still use a typewriter on certain things.
That's hilarious.
Well, kind of like on labels, and when I do journals, I use the typewriter, you know, just to do my headings and stuff like that. But yeah, it took me a long time to figure out. I don't know why, you know, somebody once said you have to think of a computer as a file cabinet. And all of a sudden it dawned on me. Oh, you have folders and you have files in the folders. That's how stupid I was. You know, I couldn't understand the concept.
That's hilarious.
Well, you know, why you do, you know, what are these folders? What are these files? What are they for? And, you know, why do you keep them? And,
oh man. You know, have you ever seen the movie Zoolander? It's like a slapstick.
I don't think so. No.
It's like, it's so stupid, the premise, but it's basically like two male models and they don't understand anything with technology. And there's a scene in it where, the guy was like, go get the files. And they're like, oh, the files are in the computer. And he like throws the computer like away, so like nobody can get the files, like throws it off a balcony or something.
Oh.
So, yeah. If you are into like that slapstick kind of comedy,
I like that kind of stuff.
You might have to go look for Zoolander and then tell me how it is.
Yeah. I will.
Well, again, Steve, thanks so much for chatting today. Definitely
you're welcome. Thank you.
Had a great time chatting and getting to know you, obviously, a little bit about your history, but then also, you know, just getting your opinion on like stuff that's going on in today's world. I think it kind of creates value for a lot of people and, you know, and as soon as we edit everything and get it up to speed on like what we think is, you know, a quality product, we'll be sure to send out a link and we'll start posting the links in the newsletters and stuff like that too. So other people can know you a little bit better as well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And thanks for the newsletters. You're very helpful. And also, I have this thing, this label in my archive. You know that I put things into. So I call it like a Zoom archive where upcoming meetings. You know, I don't have to go. I don't have to scroll down to old, you know, to emails, you know, that are 5, 6, 7 days old, you know.
Got it.
And I can just, I could search for it, but I just file it in my archive and then it's right there. And then I can pull it up and then link to the, you know, like the meeting coming up Sunday.
Yeah.
So
you're going to be at the meeting on Sunday?
Yeah. Planning.
Perfect.
Yeah,
Herzl's great. He's one of my favorite people in Denver. I don't know if you've ever heard him speak before. Very, very knowledgeable guy.
I have. Now, he's speaking on what? Or?
I'd have to check the
you know, message. I just saw
it's about the UAE, the Accords, the Abraham Accords.
Oh, the Accords. Yeah. In the Middle East.
I definitely know a little bit about that topic myself, but Herzl, you know, this is his hobby kind of thing. I mean, an amazing guy. South Africa, protesting apartheid when he was in medical school and all that good stuff. And then made Aliyah. Right. Was working in Israel for a while and then eventually moved to the States and stuff. And his, I know his son, as well a little bit through his daughter-in-law who, works on the JCRC or has in the past. So we went to Israel together.
Yeah.
So, but amazing family, and he's done some really cool things. You know, when you go over there and you're in a, you know, Jewish National Fund kind of area, like in the periphery there by the Gaza envelope, they call it, like Eshkol. And he's got a, he sponsored a, like a yoga room inside of an elementary school. So like kids are like going in there on the mats and kind of stretching out and kind of just, you know, it's just little things like that where you just, you know, like he doesn't, obviously he's a very humble guy. He doesn't really talk about things like that. He just does it. And that's what I respect about him the most.
I thought I saw an email from BMH that he was speaking. Maybe it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday evening or the day before. I can't remember. But yeah, they had an announcement that they were doing something, a Zoom. I believe he was doing a presentation.
Got it. Well, yeah, it should be an interesting talk.
I'll be looking forward to that, yeah.
Awesome. Well, hopefully I can make it, but if not, yeah, definitely enjoy seeing all the folks. Hopefully there's a little bit of a virtual schmooze session at the beginning, so at least everybody can hang out and do all that stuff. There's some different things you could do with Zoom where you could have breakout rooms and have like a little like – the conversation with 3 or 4 people. So there might be somebody that can help out with that. Or maybe I'll talk to Jim about that, but that way that like, if the first 10 minutes or something, you can just hang out with just a couple of folks that are on the call and then brings it back together.
Yeah. So. I need to practice with somebody and I don't know. Well, I have a good friend of mine who's pretty good at hosting Zoom, but I need to
We got it working today. That's a success right there.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, we did. But you see, you were hosting and I was trying to host with this other, my friend the other day. And I don't know what happened to this. Maybe it was just the sound. Maybe I've got to figure out how to, There was something on that sound. I know that it was in some other, something else. And then I switched to something like, it's like a default position or default.
Yeah.
Something. And I think that was the reason I was able to get the sound. It had it on something. And I'll have to look at that.
Yeah.
And maybe that was the problem. So.
All right.
Okay. Good seeing you. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Send me your bill at the end of the month.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah. I'm not practicing anymore, but you know, this one's free. This one's on the house.
Okay. Thanks, Ben. Take care.
Yep.
Stay well. Stay safe. Stay healthy.
Bye. Take care. The show is produced and engineered by myself, Ben, out of Denver, Colorado. Be sure to subscribe to our social media or wherever you consume content, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, etc. Big shout out to Mike Xavier. Thank you so much for letting us use your music as part of our show. Be sure to check him out as well on social media and stay tuned for the next show.